This week, I got to see the Beyond Van Gogh exhibit here in town at the Dome. Show of hands for folks who have seen this exhibit. Oh, quite a few people. Wow, excellent. And I know some people have seen it two times because it's really a lot to take in. There are three rooms to it, and in the first one, you kind of learn a little bit about Van Gogh's life, mostly through his letters. I learned how, as a young artist, he couldn't afford to pay models to sit for him when he wanted to do a portrait. So he had to use himself and his friends and his neighbors when he needed a subject. And when he painted people, they lost their ordinariness. He just had such a gift for bringing out the uniqueness, that spark of divinity in each person, that to look at one of his faces that he painted, you just are so aware that there's so much more under the surface, so much more. The second room is called the waterfall room. And in this room, what happens is the whole palette that Van Gogh used in some of his paintings, the whole range of colors, are rendered as light, and they come down the walls, and they sort of cascade down over you as you stand there. So all the different colors, you have bright whites and yellows and deep dark blues and purples, they all just wash down over you. And in the third room, there are dozens of Van Gogh's paintings that move along and across all of the walls, and they revolve and they remix themselves as they go. So at one point, you'll be standing as if in a field of sunflowers. He did so many sunflower paintings, and there'll be all the different ones around you on all sides. And then things will slowly change, and you'll find that you're walking along this windswept shore, and then they'll slowly change and blend into one another again, and then there will be cherry blossoms falling. And it's very hard to tell, if not impossible, exactly when the scene changes, because one just blends right into the next. In his lifetime, Van Gogh was never a success. He thought he had the wrong temperament to be a great artist, because his style didn't match with the previous generation of painters. His lines weren't hard and defined. Things kind of flow together in a Van Gogh painting, the edges of things, and the colors are brighter. So many people thought that this wasn't a realistic enough picture that he painted. He always compared himself unfavorably with other artists. He had to make a point of telling himself over and over again, "I am something. I am something." His peers thought him a madman. They missed so much about him. At one point in the exhibit, a song plays wordlessly. It's just a single violin, but it's a version of the song Starry, Starry Night by Don McLean, which is named after Van Gogh's most famous painting, of course, and is written to him. The singer is singing to him. The wordlessness, for me, was part of the power, because then you have to look within yourself and see if you can call up the words from your own memory. The lyric that came back to me was, "Now I understand what you tried to say to me, how you suffered for your sanity, how you tried to set people free, but they would not listen, they did not know how." Some people thought Jesus was a madman in his day. He also didn't paint a picture of things as they are. He painted them as they could be, as human beings could be, if we lived the way that God dreamed that we would, as forgiving, loving peacemakers, healing and transforming the world. He saw the depth in ordinary people. Like Van Gogh, that was his subject, that's who he focused on, and he saw that spark of God. He saw beneath the surface, past people's appearances and flaws. He thought there was more to all of us than selfishness and competition and violence. So much more. So much more. And for that, he suffered. He suffered for his sanity. People rejected him. They called him evil. They said, "We think he's gone out of his mind." They were always comparing him to others, usually John the Baptist and Elijah. They always missed his uniqueness and what he was trying to do. He tried to set people free, but as we know, they didn't always listen. They probably didn't know how. So that brings us to today, which is kind of a pivot point in Jesus' journey. He's realizing that The road ahead of him is going to involve suffering, likely is going to involve carrying a cross. So he's coming to grips with that. He's trying to figure out what God is asking of him next. And after the setbacks that have happened, it seems like Jesus is needing some reassurance. Even he needed that, as we all do from time to time. Whenever I drive home to Syracuse to visit family, I pass a place where the highway splits in two, and right beside the road I take is a big red caution sign that says, "Wrong way." Or at least it looks like that sign goes with where I'm headed. If you know the area, you know that it's actually for the other fork in the road, which is an on-ramp. It's warning you don't go that way because there's traffic coming at you. But this sign is at kind of a strange angle, so I imagine that if you're new to this area, you would stop for a moment and doubt yourself and think, well, wait a second, am I actually going in the wrong direction? When we're in unfamiliar territory, whether that's a recent grief or early recovery or a major change or a new relationship, it's easy to do this, to think that we're going down the wrong path, when really many times we aren't. It can be tough to read the signs. When something's worth doing, really worth doing, in that way that asks for all that we are, it seems to me as I get older that things tend to go one of two ways. Either everything falls into place right from the beginning, no effort required, everything flows along smoothly and there's no trouble for us at all. Or the other way it can go is that it's a struggle at every step of the way. It's the fight of our lives, but one worth fighting. So meeting opposition, even meeting suffering, doesn't necessarily always mean that we're on the wrong road. And this is when it becomes important to really listen to, as the old saying goes, to open the ears of our heart, right? A few months ago, I officiated a funeral for a woman named Betty. She was 97 when she died. All her life, she was very close to her family. For them, she was a constant presence. She had known each of them since they were born. And so now that she was gone, they of course, felt totally lost. They found they kept picking up the phone to call her, and then they'd remember that they couldn't do that. Or they'd expect to hear a call come in from her. They'd know it by a distinctive ringtone that she had. They'd programmed it for her on all their phones. This was a particular old song. Nobody else had it. This was just Betty's ringtone. And they kept expecting to hear it. The hardest thing was thinking about traveling. That was something she had really loved to do and that they'd always done together, and now they were preparing for their first vacation without her, and their hearts were really hurting. As they were making their way through the airport, the PA system was announcing the usual gate changes in that flat, monotone voice, and that was drifting down from overhead. When just for a second there was a crackling sound, and breaking through all that, breaking through this repeating cycle of boring announcements, came notes they recognized. And of course it was Betty's song, even though that song hadn't been popular in years. In fact, they had never heard it anywhere except as the ringtone on Betty's phone. And they knew it was her, reaching out to ease their troubles and telling them, "Don't worry, I'm still with you. I'm still here." Sometimes this is what God sends us. Not an answer, really. And certainly not the solution to everything we were worrying about, not the solution to all of our problems, but a sign that's unmistakable, that's clearly made just for us, that says, "I'm here. I'm still with you." When Jesus goes up the mountain, God, this constant presence for him that he's known throughout his life, sends down a familiar refrain for him that he recognizes. "You are my beloved child." These are the same words he heard at his baptism. And so now this is confirmation for him that he's on the right path. He knows that God's love hasn't changed. And we should know that it doesn't. But sometimes we start to believe this. We think we can somehow lose God's love over time. But we can't. So this is a reaffirmation. This is a great part of the spiritual journey when we receive that message. You really are enough, just as you are. We tend to read this story as the typical mountaintop experience, as if it's all transcendence and enlightenment. But really, everything's swirled together here. There's light, but there's also a cloud. Right before Jesus went up the mountain, he was thinking about the cross. So there's joy and there's suffering, there's clarity, and there's still some confusion. One blends into the other, which is just the way it tends to happen for us. The whole range of life washes down over us at any given moment. The whole palette, all different shades of lightness and darkness. We don't always know exactly when the scene changes. Usually it's only later that we look back and see when it was that we stepped from one part of our life into another one. Jesus welcomed that ambiguity. He allowed himself to welcome everything. Even before he heard God's voice, he made himself receptive to whatever was going to come. He prayed. And Luke says that when Jesus prayed, his face was changed. I love that. Prayer doesn't always alter our outside circumstances, but it changes us every time. Amen. Jesus surrounded himself with friends, another good thing to do when we feel uncertain. Friends in heaven, he has Moses and Elijah, and we all have our friends in heaven who are with us. And Jesus' earthly friends do all right in this passage. They don't always. They have kind of a checkered past, right? Peter, James, and John. And here again, their usual pattern, they don't really understand what has happened for Jesus. They don't quite get it, this experience that he's had. But Peter says, it's good for us to be here. Let's pitch three tents, one for you, Jesus, one for Moses, one for Elijah. And Luke kind of winks at us and says, yeah, Peter didn't know what he was saying. But Peter was willing to stay with Jesus, even when he didn't know what was happening. And that can be a great gift to give a friend or a spouse or a child or a parent. With any person we love, there will be times that they're going through something that deep down we really don't grasp. But we can still say, I'm in this with you. Even though I don't understand, I've pitched my tent. I'm not going anywhere. This can also be part of friendship with God, as many of us know. We've all had times when in our relationship with God, we felt confused and we didn't know what was going on. But we can keep praying. We can keep talking to God. We can try to keep the connection open as much as we can, even through those times when we don't understand. So this is a good moment, both for Jesus and the disciples. They each break through into a bit of a higher consciousness. And the interesting thing is breakthroughs like this don't always happen in our mountaintop moments. They can happen in our lowest valleys too. If you've ever looked at Van Gogh's Starry Night, it's a spiritual vision. It clearly comes from somewhere else, somewhere higher. And so you tend to assume, or at least I do, that he must have painted it out in a country field somewhere, just under this vast expanse of sky, and just in a mystical trance, like Abram in the first reading. I found out from the exhibit, it was actually painted during Van Gogh's stay in a mental institution. He checked himself in during a really difficult time in his life. And during that stretch, he was hardly allowed outside at all. All he had in his room was one tiny window. He said, through the iron bars on that window, I can make out one square of wheat and an enclosure. That was it. And he would watch the sun rise each morning, squinting out over that one scruffy patch of earth. And from that, somehow, came Starry Night. A picture so much bigger, so much more beautiful than what he could presently see. There's a universe inside us that's bigger than the whole night sky. And often it's during hard times, times when we feel trapped, when we discover who we are. That's when our spark shines forth. like Volodymyr Zelensky, a comedian who people looked at skeptically. Everyone doubted that he could be a serious force in politics, who now turns out to have not just the makings of a president, but those of a war hero. There was more to him than anyone expected, including, I would bet, himself. Like the soldiers who took a break from building barricades last week to bring flowers to their loved ones on International Women's Day, and who said, by doing that, there is more to us than this. There's more to life than war. Like the pianist who sat down in the train station in Kyiv, and there in the middle of the chaos, she played for the people rushing past. And the song she picked was "What a Wonderful World," which it is, even when it's full of suffering. There's still beauty and truth and goodness to hold on to. And God is still here. God is still with us. If you believe this, people might think you're crazy, or worse, unrealistic. But we can't let them dismiss us. On my wall, I have a quote from the environmentalist Paul Hawken. I think both Van Gogh and Jesus would have appreciated it. The most unrealistic person on earth is the cynic, not the dreamer.